Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Dr. Beke Okelina, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Nilanjana Paul, an assistant professor of history at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. Today, she'll be speaking with us about her new book, Bengal Muslims and Colonial Education, 1854 to 1947, A Study of Curriculum, Educational Institutions, and Communal Politics. Dr. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me to New Books Network. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let me begin by congratulating you for this beautiful microhistory. I will actually confess that when I got the book, I wanted to read a chapter of the book in a transatlantic flight and then go to sleep and then pick up later after my arrival, but the narrative was so compelling that I could not stop reading the book until I finished it. So thank you for this beautiful work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So could you share with our audience a little bit about your research? I'm just curious why the focus on education and specifically why Bengal?
So I just talk a little bit about my background and what, helped me or motivated me to come to this topic. I am from Kolkata, and I did my undergrad and master's from Jadavpur University in Kolkata itself. And, I took a class on Bengal politics, and it was there that I was exposed to that history extensively. And when I moved to the United States to do my PhD at West Virginia University, I was curious about looking at, the Muslim politics, in especially late 19th, early 20th century. And when I was, wanted to work on the field of education, because it was one of the most, interesting and significant areas in colonial history. And the thing is that it's not just about looking at English education or the spread of education, but also the complexities attached with the spread of education among Muslims, particularly in Bengal, which had the second largest Muslim population and one of the most important provinces in British India. So that was, one of my motivation to work on this. And second, when I started doing the research, as I was doing the archival research, this kind of attracted me because it's such a heterogeneous community. We always try to think that it's just one layer, but that's not the case. And every leadership, whether it's mainstream, whether it is on the not the main voice, they had different kinds of aspirations. So how that was played out against the background of frantic disbelief and colonial exploitation was something that I'm very interested, I got interested in as I was researching. So that kind of, you know, helped me to work on my research during my graduate school or during my PhD, and then develop this into a book.
Yeah. So in the book, you did touch on this issue of colonial exploitation, and you speak of the goal of colonial education as being the control of subjects and also the restructuring of the colonial society or the colonized society. But at the same time, you also said that that there was this inability of colonial education to address the question of mass education. So in my thinking, I'm like, okay, if the goal is to control subjects and restructure the colonial society, wouldn't you think the colonizer would want to invest more in mass education to give him or her more control? So my question for you is, why were they not able to provide mass education?
So that's a good question. And that's kind of a starting point of my book, you know. And the reason why I'm saying this, because when the whole idea of this colonial education was controlling the subjects and introducing particularly English, the language of the colonizers, so a form of centralized language would be introduced. So, and we have to look at the colonized population too, in this extremely limited structure where there were limited opportunities available. They wanted to learn English. Now, the question that you have asked me, whether it's like, you know, it would reach out to the larger mass, that was never the case. Whether it is starting with Macaulay's, you know, minutes where English becomes the most important language, and even as English becomes the most important language, we see most of the subsidy or most of, like, the whole idea was I would educate a certain section of the population, colonized population, and then it would go down. They in turn would educate the larger population. However, in doing this, it never really trickled down. And I think I've mentioned it in my book, like I've shown it, like, you know, the numbers, like how much was invested in each provinces, whether it's in Punjab, whether it's Bengal, and we see that the least was invested in Bengal. Now, you could say there were other statutes or policies like the Woods Dispatch, which was trying to bring about, you know, make a vernacular medium of instruction, and so that, you know, educate larger population. But the thing is that the popularity of English was so high, the demand was so high, that most of the money, even the fact that there was a system of grants and aid, which is subsidies, it was so high that most of it went to schools that taught English. The source of mass education were the village schools, which I have referred to, or which was referred to as pathshalas and madrasas, and they received very little from the colonial state. I mean, practically none. So the major source of education, or, you know, these village schools and madrasas, did not receive the kind of support from the colonial state as much support they the schools which provided English, or, you know, taught English. And most of them that taught English was at that point of time were missionary schools. So the you know, like, the question is, even if they were trying to, or even if they, if the whole idea was after the Charter Act of 1813, that, you know, the responsibility to educate the colonized population rested on East India Company, the reach wasn't that large. And that's why the question of mass education comes in, because it wasn't to that extent. And here, when I'm talking about masses, I'm referring to both Hindus and Muslims, particularly the village population.
Okay, yeah. So you talk about this shift, right, to English education, which you said, you know, there was a high demand for English education. So my question is, actually, I have two questions here. My first question is, why is there a shift to English education. We see that shift around 1835. Yeah. So why did this shift occur? Because it seems like the prior policy of accommodation worked well for the colonial administration because it brought them closer to the people, which made it possible for them to exercise control. So I'm wondering why there is this shift to English language. And the second part of my question is, why is there a great demand? I know you mentioned in the book that most of this demand is in the urban areas.
Now, the shift was, of course, when Warren Hastings left and successive rulers, the policy of accommodation was doing away. You know, they did away with that policy. And with specifically with Bentinck and Macaulay coming in, this whole idea of ruling this country, there has to be a centralized language, and introducing that language and controlling the subjects became very important. So, you know, it was no more like accommodating. It was now complete suppression. So that was one of the major shifts. And, you know, with making English the most important language, its popularity also increased. And also with this, what was happening was that Persian, which was, you know, the language of the Mughals and state language, that also was, you know, they no longer invested any money on buying Persian or Sanskrit books, which affected Muslims, you know, who were studying particularly in these madrasas. And I think I mentioned it in my book, you know, previous to the colonial rule, in madrasas, they were taught subjects like math and geometry. And but once they come in, once the British rule sets in, or, you know, the colonial rule sets in, there is hardly any support to these madrasas till you know, late 19th century, when some of these Muslim intellectuals, I would say, campaigned for more support for these institutions. So I think the policy of accommodation shifted to complete control over the subcontinent, or to have complete control over India, and, you know, and the replacement of Persian with English was one way of doing it. So that's like one part of that, you know, part of that policy of change.
Yeah. But most of this is happening in the urban areas, at least among the Muslim populations, in the urban areas, among elite Muslims, they're the ones who have this demand. Because you talked about the Muslims in the rural area being less inclined to accept English education. Again, this is at the same time when you have people like Justice Amir Ali, Abdul Latif, and they're all promoting English education. So my question is, why are the Muslims in the rural areas less accepting of English education?
I think the way I explain it is, you know, like when you have from the late 19th century, when you have some of these reformers, you know, campaigning for education and support from the colonial government to improve the educational situation of their community. At the same time, you know, as I mentioned earlier, one of the important sources of mass education, or educating people in rural areas, was these pathshalas and madrasas, which, especially the one in the rural areas, received very little support. Second, there was a kind of, there was poverty. So, you know, with the onset of colonial rule, the peasants were impoverished. So along with poverty, because when you have to go to like, you know, those English medium schools in urban areas, there were hardly any in rural areas, you needed to provide money or pay fees. So that, and there was also, of course, religious prejudice. Now, three combined, they stayed away from this so-called modern secular education. However, there's one other thing which is important to mention, when I think I mentioned it in my book also, like towards the end, towards the end of 19th century, when we are seeing these reforms happening, and, you know, like the Muslim population was receiving some sort of, you know, so-called modern education, or were exposed to so-called modern education. What was happening was that these intellectuals, these reformers, were kind of unwilling to bring modern education or to provide modern education to the large agricultural population living in rural areas, because then that would increase competition for employment. And so that is also an important point that I bring out in my book. You know, like the dynamics of depriving education to the larger rural population, where both the colonial government and the role that these reformers were playing and the choices that were making and how these decisions that they were making affected the larger population. And the fact is that these masses were mostly provided with some sort of religious education, which helped in hardening this form of identity, religious identity. What is today in South Asia, one of the biggest problems is identity politics. So, you know, it's helped in hardening this form of religious identity.
Okay, so there's, again, in terms of this religious prejudice, this question of religious prejudice and identity, I know in the case of, in some parts of Africa, where the British colonized, it was the question of the Muslims associating English education or Western education with Christian religious education. Was this also the case in India?
To a certain extent, yes. There, like, you know, and initially, first, you cannot afford it. Second, it was not along the lines of your, of your religion. So, and also because of the fact that, you know, like they are some of the textbooks that I also mentioned it, you know, they had derogatory content about Islam, you know, how it was a religion of violence and it deprived education to the larger population. So all these issues or all these factors were responsible for keeping a larger population away from colonial education, as I'm saying. But as we progress more to the 20th century, especially post, post-partition of Bengal and the Swadeshi movement, it was becoming, it was spreading, like people were becoming educated. But then also what was happening was that there was this demand for separate educational institutions. You know, there was also the rise of the Hindu revivalist movement, and the colonial government, in trying to cater to the Muslim needs, as trying to build them up against the Hindus, was also feeding into this.
Yeah, can you let our readers, our listeners, know a little bit about the Swadeshi movement?
Oh, so this developed post 1905, or, you know, the partition of Bengal in 1905. And so this movement that developed, it actually, you know, focused on using indigenous products, going to more national school or nationalistic schools. So there was this whole idea that we are going to boycott foreign goods, foreign schools. But it also had a very Hindu revivalist symbolism, which alienated a large Muslim population. They were unwilling to support this form of movement. Because, and I mentioned that in my book, or I discussed that in my book in extensively, and to show that, you know, any form of reforms that were introduced during, or educational reforms that were introduced during the partition or the post-partition era, how the Muslim reformers or the mainstream Muslim intellectuals were supporting that. And a section was supporting that. I wouldn't say everybody was supporting that. And then there was a section that wasn't supporting that. And how after the revocation of the partition, that group becomes stronger, led by an intellectual called Fazlul Haq. So what I'm trying to show is that I bring out through my book not just colonial education and its impact, but also looking at these different strains within the Muslim community in Bengal and how they interacted, or, you know, how they viewed colonial education in their path to progress under colonial rule.
So your response just raised so many questions for me. You know, one is on the partition, the other is on the Hindu revival that we seem to have something today of another kind of Hindu revival, Hindutization of India with Hindu nationalism. Whether there are any connections between this period you write about in your book and what is going on today, and then the politics of the partition. We know there are some Muslims who oppose the partition, and there are Muslims who are in support of the partition. Right. So could you speak more about, you know, take us behind the politics of the partition, and then we'll come to the question of the Hindutization of India.
I will, come to the question of Hindutva, or, you know, the rise of this right wing Hindu nationalism in India a little later. But I'll just, let me talk about the 20th century, you know, which I give a lot of importance in my book, because it was a period, there was so much going on at this point of time. There was partition of Bengal in 1905, the Swadeshi movement, which had this form of Hindu revivalistic symbol, which alienated a large chunk of the Muslim leadership. And, you know, so in trying to cater to their needs and, you know, and trying to develop Muslim intellectuals as opposite to the Hindus, you know, the colonial government was promoting or supporting some form denominational education. And, you know, they were supporting madrasas at this point of time, in the sense they were coming up with schemes like the reform madrasa, where, you know, in madrasas you have English education so that you could be eligible for government jobs. But still, you know, it wasn't, these schemes or these policies were not successful, because eventually, you know, as we go through the decades of 20s and 30s even towards the end of colonial rule, we see these madrasas going back to this form of religious education. And, you know, that was making them further ineligible for government jobs, because they were, of course, not exposed to modern, secular, so-called secular education. As that was happening, so there was constant tension between these communities over what kind of education should it be. As they were, you know, like as people were getting educated, there was also separatism, you know, like it was also promoting a form of religious separatism. That's what I'm trying to show through my book. And it's not, I mean, this is also shown through institutions, educational institutions. And one of the institutions that I give a lot of emphasis on in my book is Dhaka University. Though I have talked about other institutions, you know, even towards the end, I talk about female education and some of those institutions, but I have given a lot of significance or, you know, importance to Dhaka University and the communal politics over that. You know, how some of the leaders, the Hindu leaders, or, you know, vice chancellors of Calcutta University was opposing Dhaka University. And, you know, it was not the Oxford of the East, but referred to as Mecca of the East. So there was constant opposition to Dhaka University. Of course, Dhaka University had Hindu professors also. But, you know, among Muslim intellectuals, they were trying to bring in more and more Muslim students. So, and, you know, provide more opportunities to Muslim students for higher education. But that was also a problem for, you know, Hindu intellectuals or Hindu leaders. And I am also seeing, you know, like Muslims in West Bengal, when the province of Bengal was divided into two, East and West, the Muslims of West Bengal were suffering. They did not have access to the, to the madrasas or to Dhaka, always did not have access to the facilities of Dhaka University. So that was also a problem. So my goal of writing this book is not just looking at the politics, but how this politics is shaping education policy, which is promoting, you know, in shaping this education policy, it is also leading to religious separatism and hardening of right, identity politics, or, you know, hardening of religious identity.
Yeah. So we know that it wasn't all elite Hindus that were opposed to Dhaka University. Why were they, or why was there an opposition to it, or why was Dhaka University considered a threat to Calcutta University, given that both were dominated by Hindus?
Calcutta, you know, because it was considered a threat in the sense that, you know, these intellectuals or the Hindu or the, you know, leaders, they thought that most of the funds would now go to Dhaka University. Like they would, you know, the government would start supporting that, that university at the expense of this, which was supposedly the, you know, the first university in the country. So that was also a cause of concern for them. And perhaps the funding, the financial expenditure and the support was definitely a cause of concern for them. And so, I do give a lot of emphasis on the communalization of this university education, and also looking at, you know, this Dhaka education, Dhaka University becoming one of the premier institutions, and the opposition that it was facing, you know, like the fact that their standard of education is not as good as Calcutta University, it is mostly catering to Muslims. That was not the case. Of course, there was a lot of special provision for Muslim students. There was a particular Muslim hall and for students. But it wasn't just for Muslim students. I mean, they were definitely the, initially they were not more in number, but efforts were made to bring avail those opportunities for higher education to Muslims. But of course that, you know, the support that the government was giving to, or, you know, giving to this university was disliked by Hindus.
Yeah. So it also seems like there is a turning point, right, where there's this strong British anti-imperialist position in which, you know, both the Muslims the Muslims and the Hindus, you know, they come together to agitate, you know, I believe it was the Khilafat agitation, which had a very universalist overtone, and that evolved into the non-cooperation movement. Can you speak about this non-cooperation movement and how that also changed, where at some point some of the elite Muslims began seeing it as being detrimental to their own cause?
Yes, I mean, that was one of those movements which was bringing these two communities together, the non-cooperation movement. But also I mentioned it, you know, some of the Muslim intellectuals were opposing this movement because they were not about boycotting government schools and colleges. I mean, Fazlul Haq, I think I dedicate a chapter on him in my book, and he particularly talks about that boycotting any form of government institution, educational institutions would hamper the progress of the Muslim community. As it is, they were behind Hindus. As it is, you know, the government wasn't hiring all of them. Mm-hmm. You know, so on one aspect, we see that Hindus, you know, that these movements were bringing Hindus and Muslims together. But when these movements failed, there was complete communalization of politics. You know, there wasn't any further progress. You know, there was complete breakdown of law and order, and any form of unity was difficult between the two communities. And what I noticed was that, you know, there were efforts being made. I mean, of course, these were small minority groups. I mean, students were making efforts. They were writing about, and this is like once non-cooperation movement was called off, you know, students were making effort to write about promoting unity. And, you know, how, I mean, they were writing in journals talking about that, you know, how colonial education promoted this form of, discomfort or hatred between Hindus and Muslims. And there were Muslim intellectuals like Muzaffar Ahmed, like, you know, one of the important figures in, and you know, like important figures in colonial politics, but also he was this the communist leader who was also promoting, you know, unity between the two communities. He was an anti-imperialist, but and promoting unity between the two communities. So I think I touch on different aspects of the policies, but also I'm looking at, you know, different voices that were coming up in terms of colonial education.
Yeah. So you mentioned Fazlul Haq, and one example is, again, you just mentioned how he opposed the non-cooperation movements, even though he cautiously supported the Khilafat movements at the beginning. And you actually described his political career as being marked with contradictions, and you gave several examples of those contradictions. This is the way I looked at his. I look at his politics, right? He's been very pragmatic when every context to see how it favored his goals. I mean, sometimes politics is the art of the possible. Will you agree with this kind of understanding of Haq's politics, because it kept shifting and changing over time?
Yes, and to be honest with you, you know, there's a lot of work has been done on Fazlul Haq. He's a very significant figure in Bengal politics, and especially Bengal Muslim politics. Now, given the different shifts that, you know, in his policies that he was making, the different alliances he was making, and, you know, like representing the Krishak Praja Party, the KPP, the party of, the party of the Jodhars, and the different alliances that he made towards the end of colonial rule. But he was actually committed to promoting Muslim education. That he was there, you know, that was my goal of looking at it. You know, despite all these alliances that he's making and, you know, breaking, and of, you know, the new alliances that were formed, he was committed to promoting Muslim education. And he also, of course, promoted Muslim women's education. So he was pragmatic. I would say he was democratic in his own way. given the circumstances that he lived in, he worked within those circumstances to achieve his goals. And in this, he was actually making effort to promote primary education because he supported that. And, you know, different districts of East Bengal, whether it is Moymonsingho and Bogra, they were trying to bring about primary education. And he also promoted women's education by establishing or playing a crucial role in starting Lady Brabourne College in Calcutta. I mean, that's one of the most important colleges today for female education. So he was democratic in his own way. Given the circumstances, yes, he was secular, but at the same time, he wanted to promote the interests of his own community also.
Okay. Yeah. As I read your book, one of the major contributions that I think your book makes is the historiography on the 1947 partition of India. Yet in the book, you didn't talk much at all about the 1947 partition, even though you spoke about the Bengal partition. Can you just share with us more about these connections?
Sorry, can you just be a little bit more clear? I didn't get to that point of yours.
So how does your book help us understand the 1947 partition of India and Pakistan?
Okay, thank you. Now I'm a little clear with it. So my book is actually showing you this communalization of education. And in this process, how towards the end it was, the situation was so bad, it was so communal that the fact is that it starts with, these policies of appeasing one community over the other. And in trying to do so towards the end, it is such a difficult and a communal situation that it was difficult for the two communities to live together. You know, the Muslims would say it's the Hindu tyranny. We don't want to live under this, under a Hindu government, because in Pakistan, though they did not know where Pakistan is going to be, they said under Pakistan, you did not have to compete for jobs with Hindus. You can have the kind of education that you want. It wasn't like, it was an elusive dream, but they wanted that because the situation was so communal. And there was, of course, the British or the colonial government had a huge role to play, promoting this form of separatism, or, supporting this form of separatist politics led to complete breakdown of unity between the two communities.
Okay. So I'm not going to let you go without asking you, bringing you to a question I asked earlier on the Hindu revival, which you spoke about earlier, and how that fits into what we are seeing in India today. How does your book help us understand this new Hindu revival or the Hinduization of India? Or what can we learn from your book?
Yeah, I mean, this is a very difficult question. I feel when I was growing up, at least there was, this communalization, rise of Hindu identity politics, it started in the colonial period, the RSS, all of these organizations. But what we see today in India is a very virulent form of Hindutva politics, which is taking over every aspect of our lives, whether it is in education, secular ideals are not propagated, and you have to learn about these people like Savarkar in your textbooks, and especially textbooks, the way they portray the Mughal or the medieval period, and complete destruction of any form of secular ideals that we are seeing today. You know, everybody, the rise of this form of identity politics or religious, you know, hardening of religious identity, it is only giving rise to Hindu Rashtra and or Hindu nation, and we are constantly moving away from the secular ideals that our constitution laid down. I mean, 20th century, India was one of the first nation to be decolonized and achieve independence. Yes, there are several problems to the politics also. The process of decolonization had severe impact on population, mass murder, rape, and, you know, it was just a mere transfer of power. But there was a huge fight that went on. And, you know, we were trying to become a secular nation. But what we see today is, you know, we are moving away from those secular goals, and which is definitely a cause of concern for the minorities that are living, you know, like they are living in fear in India today. I mean, whether it is in terms of religion or even in terms of caste and class.
Okay, thank you so much. So what are you working on? What's your current project that you're working on?
Currently, you know, I've finished this book and I have to file my tenure. I have started working on female education in India. And I think my last chapter on the book was on Muslim women's education, particularly look at educational institutions. But now I have started working on women's education in India, particularly looking at in school education and also looking at the spread of medical education among women.
Okay, I hope you will come back to the podcast when you're done with that project and speak with us about the book.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nilanjana Paul. Thanks for sharing with us about your book. The book is available on Amazon and on major bookstores around the world. Thank you for coming on the podcast.